Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? It's a great book. You should read it. Philip K. Dick. But also, the phrase Electric Sheep is the name of the first package on the list today. The Electric Sheep is, well, complex. It is, let's call it a screensaver, but it's a lot more than that. It is a distributed rendering farm, sort of, that generates animations that you can sort of tap into and view from your computer. And the most common way to do this, I gather, is to just set it as a screensaver. There is a plugin for X Screensaver that can hook into Electric Sheep and into the network of Electric Sheep and display animations from that. Is it relevant in 2024? That's the question. It is a tough question to answer. I mean, it is art. So if art is still relevant in 2024, then yes, this is relevant. Is it the only way to get pretty pictures on your screen in 2024? No, it is not the only way. There are GPU tricks, gimmicks, really, that are just so cheap on computing power that can give you all kinds of cool designs. So if you want to see something that is being generated algorithmically for really no cost of computing to yourself, we have that now. It's not a big deal. It's easy to do. But Electric Sheep isn't just that. That's not the only selling point. The selling point of Electric Sheep is that it is an art project, a collaborative programmatical art project. The seeds of an animation, which is called a sheep in the lingo of electricsheep.org, they can come from lots of people. You can design your own sheep, and then that will propagate and grow across the Electric Sheep network. So it's an interesting idea, and you can go to electricsheep.org and sign up for register with them to gain access to really, really high resolution versions of their generative art. And it's a pretty cool thing. I mean, it really is. Like, delving into the programmer's sort of backstory, Scott Drave, it's just fascinating to see the kind of work this guy has been doing for 20 years on computer. It's really cool stuff. So go read about that. But Electric Sheep itself, you're probably not going to be able to use as it is installed right now. The version that is installed on Slackware is, let's just wait for it, packages, Electric Sheep, 2009-03-06. That's how many years ago is that now? A lot. It's a lot of years ago. And so in order to use Electric Sheep successfully, you have to, according to the message that I kept getting in the terminal as I was experimenting around with this, you must update to version 3, I think it was. What does it say? It doesn't say. It doesn't. No, wait, here it is. You must. Yeah, okay. So, no, I didn't write that down. You must update to, I think it's version 3, or maybe I'm thinking of something else. But you have to update to something, right? And it sends you to electricsheep.org. It does appear to be processing something, though. So I waited a good, like, more than 10 minutes on a quite a good internet connection, because it does say it'll take a little bit of extra time or more time than usual the first time you run it. So I wanted to give it a good 10 to 15 minutes of running to make sure that I wasn't just killing it too soon. So I waited around a long time. And while I was waiting for Electric Sheep to kick in, I downloaded Electric Sheep, the client, the source code, and I tried to compile it. Now, that required an update. No, not an update, but an install of WX widgets. And then that, and after that was done, it wanted a different version of Lua. I think it specifically was saying that it needed 5.1, and I've got like 5.3. Yeah, 5.3. And I didn't want to have to go and get 5.1 just to run this sample screensaver or whatever I was trying to do. So in the end, I did give up, but only because, well, I guess two reasons. One, because it needed an update to work, and I didn't want to bother. But the other reason is because there's almost an equally interesting related project called Flame, or Flame3. I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be Flame, FLAM3. And Flame is actually the rendering engine used by Electric Sheep. So Electric Sheep is more like the network layer, as I'm understanding it, and maybe the file protocol stuff, I don't know. But the Flame3 portion, the Flame3 code, is the thing that actually renders these pretty pictures, these animations that you could then use as your screensaver, or just, you know, to do whatever you want to with them. So I thought, well, that sounds interesting. Let's go try that out. So I got a little bit sidetracked, and I went to github.com/ScottDraves. That's ScottDraves. This is the programmer who created Electric Sheep and Flame, slash Flame, FLAM3. So that's github.com/ScottDraves/FLAM3. You download the source code to Flame, and you have to compile it first. So you do libtoolize, libtoolize, ac local, auto make --add --missing. I was probably supposed to do ac local again after that. I don't remember. Autoconf. AUTOCONF. We've gone all over all this stuff before in previous episodes about GCC and the build process. So once all that's done, then you do a ./configure, and then make, or if you want to use more than one CPU core as you're making, or I guess more threads, well, more CPUs, I guess. Make -J and then some number. So usually they say look at your CPU cores in your PC. -1 for safety, and use that number. I used 4 because I had a hunch that this wasn't going to take that long, and indeed it didn't. Then I made a directory called flame-git-886_64-1_smi for slackermedia.info. You could use SBO, you could use whatever you want. It's just a tag. And then I issued the command make install dest-dir equals, and then the path to that directory that I just created. So that takes all the stuff that I made in the previous step and installs it as if though that directory were the root directory of my system. Then I changed directory into flame-git-x86_64-1_smi and did a sudo make pkg-ly-cn. I don't remember what those options stand for. It's just part of the incantation at this point. /tmp/flame-git-x86_64-1_smi.txz. This creates a package out of the contents of the current directory and dumps it into your /temp directory, and then you can use install pkg, or more specifically sudo install pkg/temp flame *txz. That installs Flame onto your system. What do you do with it? Well, you go back to the source code directory, wherever you downloaded that. And you can now use the flame-animate command to ingest a test file that provides parameters for an animation. You do that with flame3-animate, redirect, or I guess really a less than sign, test.flame3, FLAM3. The test.flame3 is, I don't know why I'm saying this so many different ways, test.flame, keeping in mind that flame is spelt FLAM3. So test.flame is an XML file. It has things like the time code that you want to, or the time span you want to animate for, the size, the frame size. By default, it's 640 by 480. If you're on a modern computer, frankly, there's nothing stopping you really from just upping that to 1920 1080 at least. And there's a filter. You can see a list of all the filters, I think, with just Flame. I think if you just type in Flame at the in your terminal, it'll just dump out all the filters. I could be misremembering. A quality, the background color, the brightness, the gamma, the hue, and so on. And then you use XForm tags to provide characteristics of this animation. And I didn't read all the documentation, so basically I just followed, when I was messing around with this after doing the test animation, I just modified what was there. And it's fun and it's kind of cool. You have color values that you can use and coefficients that you can provide that then changes sort of really as I understand it, the seed data from which the animation is derived. So once you look at it, certainly if you read the documentation, I think you'd probably get a lot more out of it. But I mean, once you even just look at it, you kind of get the idea pretty quickly. It's really basic XML with something that might remind you of like SVG. Okay, so you don't need to know any of that. You have flame-animate redirect test.flame. And that's a redirect, meaning you're redirecting test.flame flame into flame-animate. This creates a file. Well, actually, it creates, in this particular case, 100 files. Why 100? Well, because in flame time equals, quote, 100, so that's the end point of this animation, and then you've got a bunch of values demonstrating what the endpoints are. It's set to time 100, so that's, you get 100 frames, or actually 99, but I mean, because it starts at zero, so you still get 100 images, but they're numbered 0 to 99. And that's just in the current directory, and they'll be called 000, well, 00.png all the way up to 00099.png. You notice that that has five digits, 000 and then two integers. I mean, I guess zero is probably an integer as well. I don't know how this works. It's math. So you got 100 images, and you could certainly just open them up in a image viewer, but it's I think more of the intent for you to create a movie out of these. So the canonical way to do that is ffmpeg space dash f as in, not file, format, I think, dash f as in format, image 2, dash I as in input, dot slash percent 05 d as in delta dot png. So what that says is that I want ffmpeg to assume 5 digits, percent 05 digits. So that's 0000. I lost count. Five zeros, and then just start counting up from there. So that's an easy way to just grab all 100 images in order, and no less and no more. Dash v codec copy my movie or my animation dot mkv. Okay, you just made a little movie out of 100 frames. So it's not going to last a really long time, but it'll be enough. You know, it's not going to fly by. You can see it. And to see it, you can use any number of video players. We just talked about MPlayer not too long ago, so you could use that. You could just use Dolphin, whatever you want to use, VLC, whatever. Play the animation, and it is really nice. It's really cool. I can see the appeal here, actually. If this is what Electric Sheep is all about, this is really neat. I think it would be a lot of fun, potentially, to mess around with that flame, that test.flame, that sort of flame XML, and see what kind of weirdness you can generate. So if you've never done any kind of generative art, or you're just not sure whether you have a creative bone in your body, or you do have a creative bone in your body, but you just don't know how to express that on a computer, this is kind of a cool way, possibly, to exercise that. You can use just, I mean, it's, I know, I think of, oh, it's just XML, so that's super easy. And I know XML can look scary, but please trust me, this little test.flame thing, I mean, I'm sure that it uses a fraction of the potential of flame, But as a starting point, I really do think that this is quite simple. You kind of get the idea. It opens with a test tag, which is also conveniently the name of the file, probably related. And then flame, time equals zero. And then it goes on from there. And then flame time 100. And so you get the idea. It's like, okay, at zero, these are our starting values. And then at 100, those are the finishing values. And everything in between is going to be calculated by flame. So it's pretty easy to kind of imagine what you might do with that information and how you might change it. I think it's probably worth looking at. And so in a weird way, that's got nothing to do with electric sheep, but everything to do with electric sheep. And I do think it's worth looking at. I don't know that electric sheep itself is worth the trouble. I mean, I don't know. Like, meaning, I don't know. It might be the coolest thing in the world that I'm missing out on. All I know is that it took a little bit more effort than I was prepared to go to for a thing that I didn't really see myself using all that often. I don't use a screensaver. I don't sit around just staring at, OpenGL animations. So, I mean, not that this is OpenGL, but, you know, like that kind of like generative art animation, unless maybe I could turn it on in like Audacious and have some kind of cool like visual for music. But even then, I don't really do that. I didn't think I was going to use it. I don't think I'm going to use it. It's going to be uninstalled, in fact, on my computer. But Flame, I'm keeping installed because I really do think that I'm probably going to mess around with that. So that's weirdly 2-for-1 or 1-for-0. I don't know. But check that out. Next up is FFmpeg Thumbnailer. We just were talking about FFmpeg. FFmpeg, of course, is a video processing engine that powers a lot more than you realize. It's just such a heavy hitter in open source and in the world of video. And here it is being utilized as a little bit of a it's a command to grab a single image from a video, and then you can use that image as a thumbnail for a video file. Now, for that to work, you need a file manager that knows how to leverage FFmpeg Thumbnailer, but I think a lot of them these days do leverage that. They have that ability. So, and it might not be on by default. It might be something that you have to go activate in preferences or settings or whatever of your file manager. Dolphin, I think it is on by default, but even that, and I guess I don't technically know that that's using FFmpeg Thumbnailer. I imagine it probably is. I could be wrong. But either way, the thumbnailing function of Dolphin, like, it's on by default, but then you have to go and set it for, like, I think remote files, because just to reduce sort of processing time, a lot of times there's a threshold. Like, don't try to make thumbnails of remote files that are greater than 5 megabytes or whatever. So you might have to activate that. But you don't have to use it in your file manager either. You can, it is a command that you can use. And the syntax is super intuitive, actually. It's FFmpeg Thumbnailer, FFmpeg Thumbnailer space dash I for input, sample dot mp4, dash O for output, my picture dot JPEG. Hit return. And depending on the size of the input movie, it might take more or less time than what I've just done. I've used a tiny little clip of a 15-second video, so it took no time at all. But if I do an ls here, there it is, my picture.jpg. And so if I do display my picture.jpg, there's the picture. I definitely recognize that as a frame from that video. Now, there's a bunch of other options, though. Not a bunch, but there's a couple of cool ones. There is, you can define how much of the video you want it to look through with a dash T for time to sync. There is also the dash F to create a movie strip overlay. So make it look like it's a little clipping from a film reel. That sounds kind of fun. Let me do that really quick. Yep. Oh, that's nice. It's got little sprocket holes on the left and the right side, like it's 35 millimeter film, or I guess 16 millimeter, or any millimeter except not the supers. So yeah, that's fun. There's ignoring the aspect ratio and just forcing it to be a square thumbnail, and there's quality. Oh, and size, the thumbnail size by default is 128 pixels, so that's a little bit small. Maybe you need something larger. Well, you could do dash, what is this, S for size, and then I don't know, if like 512 maybe, and now I'll display. Yep, that's a larger image. Fun little command, pretty simple, quite convenient if you need that sort of functionality. Next up is Fluxbox. And Fluxbox is, I don't think it's technically the first desk. Well, I know it's not technically the first desktop. Well, it's not a desktop. It's a window manager. It's not the first graphical environment I ever used with Linux. And that even that is a little bit confusing because I didn't actually start on Linux. I started on Unix. So it's not the first, but it was definitely one of the early ones. And in terms of the ones that kind of stuck, it was definitely Fluxbox. I ran Fluxbox almost exclusively for years and years and years, and didn't really switch to KDE until KDE 4. It was, of course, called KDE back then. It wasn't the Plasma desktop. It was just KDE Plasma. And that was version 4. I went to the big release event, which was held in Mountain View, California, I think it was, in some kind of Google headquarter building or adjunct building. I don't know. It was a building that was owned by Google. And I got the opportunity to go, I think as a sort of member of the press, as it were, or just a fan, really. I mean, it wasn't terribly exclusive. And I just happened to be in the area. So I attended, and it was really exciting to see all the progress that was happening on Linux desktops. And I kind of fell in love with KDE from that point on. But I mean, even after that, I was using Fluxbox quite a lot, and what I would sort of typically do in my very frequent kind of like never just run one thing attitude, I very frequently ran Fluxbox either at work and then KDE at home, or the other way around, just depending on the specs of the computers involved. Like sometimes my work machine was less good than my home machine, so I would use the better machine to run a big heavy desktop and the worse machine to run a very simple window manager. And that is kind of one of those arguments for Fluxbox. Like regardless of any kind of preference, it's just sometimes you just need not a whole desktop. And Fluxbox is a very simple environment. It is a little bit like Blackbox. Well, I mean, apparently it was based on Blackbox, so it's a lot like Blackbox, but kind of like Openbox, or even more recently, if you've ever heard of i3 or the Awesome Window Manager, all those kinds of very bare bones, like let's just put, you want a window? Here's a window on your screen. Like that's kind of all it provides. Now that window might be a window with lots of, you know, with normal standard sort of window decoration, or it might just be an element of something like a panel to hold like little widgets that you go to frequently, like a network manager, so you can choose what Wi-Fi network to connect to, or a volume control, so you can adjust the volume of your computer and so on. Now, the mix of those elements is really up to you. And that's, again, one of the advantages of something like Fluxbox, where you don't really have to take all the stuff that you don't feel is necessary. The KDE Plasma desktop has a lot of stuff sort of running at all times. Like if you look at, you know, if you look at your running processes, there's just so much going on, and a lot of it traces back to just the thing that is providing you pretty pictures on your screen that you might not even be looking at or really focusing on for most of the time. I mean, one example. On KDE Plasma desktop right now, if I have a file copying from one folder to another, the overlay of my dolphin icon in my panel it progresses. It starts out just normal, and then as the process continues, it sort of overlays that icon with a shade of green. And so whenever I want to check on the process of the thing that's happening, I can look up and maybe see, you know, how that's going, how that's progressing. And that's a really cool feature. But I mean, that's one of those things that if you don't need it, and if you don't necessarily want your computer to be thinking about that, then maybe you don't want that feature on your graphical environment. Fluxbox is never going to do that. Or I mean, it might if you have a cool widget that you know of, or you've programmed that has that kind of functionality. But generally speaking, that's not the sort of thing you get with a window manager. They don't have features like that, because a window manager simply provides windows, an application menu, and then maybe some kind of icon functionality or panel functionality. Everything on top of the basics is something that you need to kind of plug in and integrate yourself, which you can do through text, plain text configuration files. That's one of the main, features of Fluxbox, is that all of its configuration can be done in plain text files. You don't need to know really like a programming language or a markup language. You don't need a preferences or a setting application. You just type stuff out into a document. Now, that is both liberating and, I guess, terrifying, because after all, what if you don't know what to type? That's a real problem. You just don't know all the options until you know all the options. And there are a lot of options. In my init file for Fluxbox, I have 84 lines of options that I've put in here. And it's stuff from kind of really important stuff, I guess, like, I'm trying to find one that's important. I can't find one that's important. They're all equally unimportant. But I mean, there are some like, well, here, session.screen0.slit.alpha:255. session.screen0.slit.onhead:0. Oh, session.screen0.slit.placement:left bottom. So that places the slit on the left bottom of screen 0 specifically. So those are kind of important, but something like, or something that's actually not important now. Well, that's actually important too. Everything's important now, all of a sudden. session.screen0.clickRaises:true. session.screen0.autoRaise:true. I mean, a lot of these, here's session.screen0.menuDelay:200. Oh, here's a good one. session.screen0.opaqueMove:true. So that just keeps, when I'm moving the windows, that ensures that the window is opaque during the move. You could make that not be the case, and then you would have I think that's the mode where it gives you just a wireframe of the window while moving the contents, which is obviously easier on your display on your computer, because now it doesn't have to calculate like all those pixels that it's moving. It just draws a little wireframe, you put it down, and then the window appears. I'm pretty sure that's what that does. So all of those options, like, how do you know about those options? How would you ever know that session.screen0.opaqueMove:true or false? How would you know that exists? And it can be difficult to know, but you just have to read Fluxbox documentation, and it reveals most of these to you. I'm pretty sure that's how I found them. You can also just look at other people's configuration files. Now, this is the init file. So that's the file that when you launch Fluxbox, it steps through the init file in order to initialize. So all of these options are set once at the very beginning of your session. That's why they all start with session dot and then some property, and there are different properties. Some are screen specific, others are just global, like session.apps file. Where do I keep my apps? Well, I keep them in, or I kept them in /.fluxbox/apps. If I was going to use this init file now, I think I would put all of that into like .local/share, or maybe, I don't know, just .config, something like that. Or, you know, /.config. There's session.style file. Those were kept in user share Fluxbox styles. And I was most recently using Bora Black. And those are in user share because USR share, because I got those, I think either I got them from slackbuilds.org or I made a Slack build file or a Slack build script that installed it globally, because to my mind that was a global thing. I think I might, you know, today I guess I've somewhat more accepted that we're all just single user machines now. And then there's session.menu file. So this is the menu that comes up on your screen when you right-click on just empty space. That's that app menu. And I kept that in /.fluxbox/clatu menu. There's a session key file. That's not cryptography keys. These are keys for keyboard shortcuts. So you can kind of build. Oh, yeah. And then there's the slit list, which is the stuff contained in the slit, in which a slit is a little bit like, you could think of it as a system tray. It's not actually a system tray. It's the slit. Where the slit exists is up to you. You define that in your init file. So you've got somewhere, traditionally it was in /.fluxbox, but somewhere in your configuration you have an init file. And in that init file you set a bunch of properties. Now if you don't have an init file of your own, don't worry. One comes along with Fluxbox. It'll just happen whether you're not going to ever boot Fluxbox, start Fluxbox and just get a blank screen because you didn't have the right init file. Well, I mean, I guess if you have like a seriously corrupted init file, who knows what'll happen. But I mean, generally speaking, if you don't have an init file, Fluxbox launches with its default settings, not a big deal. But you can have an init file to set up a bunch of things that you want to be configured in a specific way. And then there are a lot of other files that you could have that you reference in the init file as I've just talked about. So for instance, there's the keys file. And this was great. I mean, this was one of my favorite features about Fluxbox, and I guess it kind of still is. But you could, you know, there's a bunch of like default key bindings, like I think Alt F2 is it, causes the FB run, like the little command, you know, a quick command field to appear on your screen. So it's a little bit like pressing the Windows key on a desktop. Or on KDE or GNOME, you get like that kind of now search for an application. So that's what you get. I think it was Alt F2. I didn't use Alt F2, but I think that was what the default was. And you have also things like on desktop mouse 1, hide menus, on desktop mouse 2, workspace menu, on desktop mouse 3, root menu. So this is defining what happens when you click on desktop. On desktop mouse 4, I think that's the scroll wheel. That's the previous workspace. And then on desktop mouse 5 is the next workspace. So I guess 4 is probably up and 5 is down, maybe. And then you've got things like on window, mod 1 mouse wheel, macro command raise focus start moving. I don't know what any of that means, but it's basically saying that if you do an alt and then left or right click on a window, it raises it to be the active window and focuses it, or rather it raises it above all other windows and then focuses it and starts to move wherever your mouse goes. So that's really cool. Why things are called like mod 1 and mouse 1, I get that keyboards and mice are different, so I guess that makes sense, but to me, a lot of those are, it just takes an extra mental cycle to sort of decrypt that. Luckily, I've commented my key file quite well. Thank you, past me. Here's Alt Tab. So mod 1 tab is next window, and then mod 1 shift tab is previous window. So kind of standard stuff. The stuff that I really enjoyed though and used all the time were the things that you could define yourself. So I had, I think it was the little Windows key on the keyboard, and then any letter. So these were my global keyboard shortcuts. So mod 4T opened a terminal, specifically exec console. Mod 4K opened Conqueror, which was the file manager before Dolphin, and I was actually using it, I think, as a web browser at this time, exec Conqueror. Mod 4Z, exec FB run, that's that little pop-up command field. Mod 4F, exec, Firefox, and so on, and just down the line, like letters and letters and letters. Just I could just open up my most frequent applications at just a keyboard shortcut, and it was always mapped to the super key or the Windows key or mod 4 apparently, because I knew that if I pressed that in some key, I could open an application. I used that all the time. I don't know why that was my workflow then, but I just absolutely just couldn't live without it. There are volume settings, and you can use XEV, which we talked about in the previous folder, the X folder. XEV tells you what key codes you can, certain buttons generate. So you can find the key codes of your dedicated volume keys, if you have dedicated volume keys on your keyboard, and then set some mixer, some audio mixer, to raise or lower your volume. And so on. And it just goes on and on like that. Once again, 126 key definitions. Not all of them custom. A lot of those are just kind of the default keys. But those are the things that you can have. And then finally, I guess there's the menu file. And this is a really important one. Like, by default, usually Fluxbox has some kind of thing in /etc/, I don't know, somewhere, that auto-detects, or, you know, that looks at your user share applications and probably your /.local/share/applications and kind of generates an application menu for you. And it works quite well. It's very much appreciated, but it never served me well. I never liked that, because you end up with a bunch of applications that in real life you just don't ever use. And if you do want to use them, you can go to the application directory yourself, or you can just type in the name of the application in a terminal and launch it manually. My menu, I wanted to be highly kind of like functional. I wanted it to be a thing that I would use, you know, I wanted it to be populated with things that I wanted to use frequently. And I didn't want the cruft. I didn't want the extra stuff. So the syntax of the menu is admittedly a little bit weird. I mean, you get the feel for it pretty quickly, but I will admit that the syntax, I don't absolutely love the syntax of this, but it's things like square bracket begin, close square bracket, parentheses, Fluxbox, close parentheses. So that's saying begin the menu and title the menu Fluxbox, and then square bracket, next line, square bracket, submenu, square bracket, parentheses, apps, close parentheses, curly brace, square bracket, submenu, close square bracket, parentheses, text editors, close parentheses, curly brace, and you'll see the purpose for all these curly braces in a moment, in fact, in the next one. So right now we're in the menu, the begin menu, right, and then we're in a submenu called apps, and a submenu within that called text editors, or whatever I said, and so then an item in that submenu is, for instance, square bracket exec, exec as in executes, close square bracket, parentheses, emacs, close parentheses, curly brace, /usr/bin/emacs, close curly brace. And then for some reason, I don't remember the reason for these, less than and greater than brackets. I do not remember the purpose of those, and not all of those have, not all of my entries have those. I don't know if what the heck that is. But anyway, it's there. It doesn't hurt, I guess. The point is, though, you're getting the idea of the structure, sort of. You open up elements with square brackets, the topmost being the menu itself, but then everything within that can be a submenu if you want, or you could just dump exec items straight into the menu, however you want to structure it. But really, you probably want submenus, because Fluxbox, I mean, if you click and it goes, if the menu goes off screen, you're just out of luck. So, well, you're not out of luck, you just go and edit your file again and introduce submenus, but I mean, it's convenient to have submenus. And within the submenus, you can have actions. And these actions generally are defined as executables or you know, exec, EXEC. Although there are other things like square bracket restart, close square bracket, and that is a restart action that in this case runs, because I have parentheses flux, close parentheses, curly brace, /user/bin/start Fluxbox, close, that restarts Fluxbox itself. There are other things, though. There's a way to list your styles. So that would be square bracket styles dir, close square bracket, and then the path in parentheses to the different Fluxbox styles that you have on your system. And so on. Again, the documentation explains it pretty well, and more often than not, you're going to look at an existing example and just kind of modify those, because usually they are really, really useful. And that's not all. I mean, there's more you can define. There are startup actions. So I loved this too about Fluxbox. You could just have a startup file, a file called startup in your .fluxbox directory. And if it's there, Fluxbox runs everything in your startup file. This is how you populate your desktop, or rather your slit and other things like that, with the little applications that you might want to run, or quick little settings that you want to have initiated after Fluxbox has launched, but before you actually interact with Fluxbox. So, for instance, in my startup, I had an xmodmap command to read in my .xmodmap file, so my keyboard would be adjusted in the ways that I wanted, specifically turning off converting the caps lock key to just a control key, that kind of thing. And then I launched little applications that I liked, like Clipper, put an ampersand by it to ensure that Fluxbox continues to read the file. But KMix, I used to use that. So KMix ampersand, I started X screensaver ampersand, and then a bunch of little widgets that I kept off to the side. They're called docklets, I think, or dockers, or I think docklets. WMCPU load ampersand, WM weather, plus a couple of arguments to define where I was, ampersand, WMND, I don't remember which one that was, ampersand, WMTOP, that was really useful, showed you the top processes, ampersand, WMAUDA, A-U-D-A, that was an audio mixer, ampersand, I think, was it? No, that was Audacity, I think, a player. WMix was the volume control, maybe? I don't remember. But there's a bunch of little applications that I would run just kind of off to the side, and they would just be there when I launched Fluxbox because they were in my startup file. You can also do things like eval backtick cat tilde slash dot fbg close tick ampersand, which evaluates the contents of a file called .fehbg, which is the there's a command called feh, F-E-H, and it has the ability to set the root window of your machine, that is your desktop, to a specific image. And so you put an image name in .fehbg, or actually I think a whole command, it was fb set bg. Is that right? Or is it a separate command? I don't know. But you put an image in there, and then, it must be the full command, because otherwise how would it know? Yeah, okay. So it's the full command, fb set bg, I guess, and then a path to the image that you want to display on your desktop, and that happens here. And then, I have a command here to actually start Fluxbox, exec Fluxbox, because it's the last app, you have to run it with exec before it. Huh, I thought this happened before init, but now it sounds like maybe startup happens, or rather, I thought this happened after init, but now it sounds like it happens before init. Okay, well, I've forgotten the order of some of the processes here, I guess. That's the kind of configuration power that you have. Docklets, that's what they were called. Did I say docklets? I think I did. That's the kind of configuration you have with Fluxbox, and it is super liberating. I mean, you can just absolutely design your own experience. And maybe you can't quite, like, design your own experience. Like, if your experience of perfect design, if you could design anything, you might, I don't know, do a cool 3D desktop with windows that you can flip around and write notes on the back of or something. I don't know. Who knows what you would do? You're not going to do all that on Fluxbox. Fluxbox, there's a set of tools that you can use, and you can place them in certain corners of the screen, and then you've quote-unquote designed your own desktop. But that said, I mean, you really do feel like you have a lot of control over basically every element available to you in Fluxbox, and it's really neat. And if you've never tried just a window manager, personally, I would suggest Fluxbox. I'm strongly biased, but that's kind of where suggestions come from usually is a preference. And so I have a certain preference for Fluxbox. I think it's really easy to use and to configure. And I think it's just really, really, I mean, it is really lightweight. Like, it's not going to burden your computer. Like, you may feel like your computer is going faster because of Fluxbox. I mean, and it may or may not be. It kind of depends on the use case, but certainly Fluxbox without a bunch of fancy effects and stuff, it just does kind of tend to feel and maybe look a little bit snappier than things where you have windows fading in slowly because you like the effect. So Fluxbox is a very, very cool system. It is not a desktop. It doesn't provide all the extras. You have to pull those from other places, but you're perfectly capable of doing that. Like, Fluxbox allows that, as do most of those desktops. I mean, I don't know about GNOME, but I mean, XFCE, KDE, there are elements from both of those that you could incorporate really easily. And then there are purpose-built things as well, like the Tint 2 panel. I don't know if that's still around, but it used to be a kind of a cooler looking panel than the default Fluxbox panel, that sort of thing. So you've got a lot of flexibility, and it's just a lot of fun. So try Fluxbox if you haven't, but not until you've gone and gotten a cup of coffee. Okay, I'm back. I've got yet a different coffee. I happened to go to Dunedin the other day to drop a friend off at the airport, and so I stopped by the old reliable Big Ben store and just scooped out a bunch of coffee. I think this one's called Unwind, and it's fine. It's good coffee. I'm enjoying it. I will admit, today I'm a little bit down on this coffee. Not for any good reason, but yesterday I went to this co-work space, like one of those places where they just have a bunch of desks and the network and a coffee machine, and you pay like $25 and then that's your office for the day. So I went there and was working in an office just for a change of scenery, really. And it was fun. And they had this really, really good coffee there, like really good coffee, like $25 for an office space and that coffee. It's highway robbery, with me being the robber. I mean, I just felt like I was exploiting so much. I got free fruit, I got free coffee, and it was really good coffee. I got to use this huge monitor, like a Dell curved monitor or something. It was a nice experience. I don't know if I'll do that very frequently, but it was a nice little bit of a treat. And yeah, that the quality of that coffee is kind of, I don't know, I miss it already. But anyway, we have a lot more apps to go through and not a bunch of time. So let's just talk about free RDP. I didn't know what free RDP was. I didn't know what RDP was. I think I'd vaguely heard of it. I had to look it up. It's a remote desktop protocol. According to Wikipedia, it's a proprietary protocol developed by Microsoft Corporation, which provides, I think I would go with that, provides a user with a graphical interface to connect to another computer over a network connection. The user employs RDP client software for this purpose, while the other computer must run RDP server software. Cool. Says it all. So it's like VNC or X forwarding, sort of. Well, it's more like, I guess, VNC, really. So free RDP is the open source, is at least an open source implementation of this. I mean, it might be the open source implementation. I don't know. I haven't really looked into how many other RDP implementations there are, but this is an open source one, and it's actually, yeah, pretty easy to use. I don't know if I guess it's easy to use. I don't know how I feel about it. I feel like I'd probably just use VNC personally, but I guess this is nice. And for a Windows user, I imagine this would be really useful, because I think Windows probably has this stuff really just kind of built in, I would imagine. So I opened up my virtual machine and started the server, the free RDP server. which is not very well documented. This whole thing is not very well documented. But I mean, it's all there. You just have to like sort of piece things together and kind of find tips and tricks. It doesn't step you through the process, but here's the process. You go to the other, you go to the remote machine, the one that you're going to want to log into. In my case, that's my virtual machine, Slackware. So go there, freerdp-shadow-cli. So that's freerdp-shadow-cli. It's a shadow command line interface, I guess. I don't really understand what that is, but apparently that's the server. So type that in, hit return, and it gives you something that almost looks like an error. I mean, honestly, it's kind of like a bunch of stuff about X and Zinarama and X damage. You might mistake it for an error, but then if you keep reading, it's listening on 0000:3389. Okay, so it is actually listening, so this is a server. All right, now I'm going to go back over to my desktop computer and type in xfreerdp-u for user. Oh, sorry, xfreerdp space dash u for user. And in this case, bogus, because that's the name of the user on my virtual machine. Dash p for password. And in this case, that's bogus123, because that's what I use on fake installs. And then the only way I could get this to work, and this doesn't make any sense to me, but I got errors otherwise, but dash dash app dash dash plugin rail, R-A-I-L, dash dash data slash bin slash TCSH, dash dash, so now we're ending that command, and then I pass in the IP address, 192.168.122.82. So the thing that's confusing me about this is that this technically, as I understand it, is running a single app on the remote machine, which is specifically slash bin slash TCSH. That's the C shell, the modern C shell, TCSH, which is like a shell that I quite like, but I had expected something different. What happens when I hit return after that command is that a new window appears, which for several minutes I mistook for just my virtual window, my virtual machine window. I couldn't even tell that a new window had launched because it looks exactly like, you know, like a virtual machine, like a little window in virtual machine, in Vert Manager. So, but you hit that and eventually, yes, a window does appear, identifying itself as freerdp:192.168.122.82. And there's the window. There's the machine. That's the virtual machine right in that little window. And you can click on it and move windows around. And you see it because I do have my virtual machine window open as well behind it. And if I move it over, you can see, like, you know, what you do in one window is mirrored in the other because that's, those are both looking at the same machine. Yeah, it's kind of neat. It's kind of fun. I mean, it's like I say, it's really no different than VNC. It kind of weirded me out that I didn't have to provide like a bunch of credentials and that I was just able to launch with just a username and a password. That felt a little bit weird, but that doesn't mean there aren't other ways to do this. I don't know the intended use case. I don't know the best practices, and FreeRDP certainly isn't telling me, at least not out in the open. Like, maybe it's buried somewhere in their wiki, which they cite as their official documentation. But honestly, it's a GitHub wiki. But honestly, it seems to be geared mostly toward developers because I found very little of use for just someone who wants to like use the thing. I get the sense that probably Windows users, or maybe especially Windows sysadmins, maybe this just all makes sense. Like, this is probably very commonplace and it's probably just a quirk of my complete lack of understanding of how Windows works and interacts. This is just completely puzzling to me. I don't know why I had to pretend like I was launching just a single application for this not to error. Maybe I can just take that stuff out. Can I just do that? Let me try one more thing real quick. There's that. And then I go over here and I just try to, no. Yeah, I don't know how to just, oh, there, right there. Okay, now I've learned. So it is freerdp or xfreerdp-u bogus-p bogus123, that's user and password, and then just the IP address, and that launches it. As long as, of course, your destination is running an RDP server, which, as far as I can tell, that's just free rdp-shadow-cli. I didn't see anything at etsy/rc.d. I didn't see any other. I think that's the server, free rdp-shadow-cli on the remote machine, and then on your local machine, you're using xfreerdp as your client application. And then last but not least, just because I want to get through at least the Fs in this episode. So last but not least is FVWM. This is an iteration on, or at least it began as, modifications to TWM. You remember TWM from the X directory, from X11. It's the sort of fallback, have to provide people with a desktop. Okay, well, here's a desktop kind of application that ships with Zorg, or X.org, or X11, whatever we call it. So after several years of iterating on, like, this mod pack for TWM, they released it as its own thing called FVWM, and you can find out more about that if you want at fvwm.org, I think. I haven't been there in a long while. Nope, yeah, it's still there. Cool. So it's a virtual window manager, which I don't really know what that means exactly, but the website talks a lot about all of its sort of features and its compliance with all the different specifications and stuff. And it is meant to be highly customizable, kind of like Fluxbox, really. I mean, there's custom key bindings you can create, mouse gestures, which is pretty cool, theming, scripting, and so on. And it is, it's like, you know, it's a window manager. So you're going to see similarities between FVWM and Fluxbox, or TWM, certainly, or even a little bit Window Maker, or Black Box, and so on, where you kind of right-click on the screen, and you get the menu, or maybe it's not a right-click, I don't remember, in FVWM. But FVWM ships, obviously, with Slackware, so you can just start using it. You use XWM config, right? Is that the correct XWM config? Yeah, XWM config, set your environment to FVWM, and you're good to go. You're in FVWM now. In fact, I'll do that in this little VM right now, XWM config, and I'm gonna choose FVWM2, and then exit, and I'll log out of the desktop for now, which gets me back to SDDM. And I just want to see if that's a, no, it is not a, it's not an option from there. So you do have to pretty much, you have to launch this, I guess. I mean, unless you want to mess around with SDWM or SDDM configurations, which I don't. I guess you would have to pretty much start this manually. And that would just be a start X command. And there we are. So by default, you've got a perfectly usable FVWM instance. You've got a panel along the right-hand side, which shows you the workspaces, which are clickable so that you can switch between them. And you've got the application menu with a left click. So it's not a right click, it's just a left click. Now, the bare, you know, the basic default configuration isn't what I would call necessarily beautiful. It kind of resembles, you know, like Windows 95 or something like that. It's very blocky and kind of really basic. But if you go to box-look.org, you can grab FVWM Crystal, which is not too bad. It's quite nice. And then you can have a very, very different looking FVWM, because it is highly themable, and the crystal look gives you like an application menu bar, so that you have icons along the top, and there's each icon contains related application launchers, so the GIMP icon will show you image editors, not just GIMP. KDevelop icon, at least on my system, reveals a bunch of development environments like IDEs, things like that, if you have any installed, and so on. So you've got sort of a built-in theme, or not built-in, but a new theme with FVWM Crystal, or anything you find on box-look.org. It's a nice little site for like window manager, you know, Fluxbox, OpenBox, FVWM themes. And just as on Fluxbox, you can use Feh, F-E-H, install, or not install, but to apply a background. So that's just F-E-H, Feh, dash dash BG dash scale, and then a path to an image, and that'll scale that image up to fit into your root window. All of the configuration files are in either your home.fvwm-crystal or in just out in user share fvwm-crystal. It's a fun desktop. I've used it for not very long, but like a week or something like that, just kind of to get a feel for it for an article that I wrote a long time ago. And I liked it. Yeah, it was fine. And like, I mean, it's as fine as TWM, as long as you put a couple of styles and modifications into TWM. It's fine. It's not Fluxbox. And it's kind of funny to say that, because it's just like, well, is it not Fluxbox, or do you just not know it like Fluxbox? Because I mean, there's probably a lot of configuration I never did to FVWM, but it's a fine little desktop. It's snappy. It's got themes, so it doesn't look as sort of basic as it does by default. And it's fast. It's very fast. For me, Fluxbox is just going to always be, or at least for a very long time, it has been the thing that I turn to for a simple window manager, just because I know how to configure it, I know what my options are, and it's just kind of the easy way to go. Well, you know what? Fluxbox and Enlightenment, to be fair. Both of those I quite like. I feel pretty good about. I don't know if I feel great about Enlightenment. I just enjoy Enlightenment. I don't know that it's as robust as it ought to be for daily use. But anyway, point is, Fluxbox or a box is a good thing to have in your back pocket in case you ever need it. It's right there. And FVWM kind of qualifies. So check that out if you're looking for something other than Fluxbox or Blackbox or the other ones. Okay, I think that's it. I've only gotten through like maybe 5 applications, but these are, you know, meatier applications than like the X11 libraries. They're fun to talk about. I've got things to say about them because I've actually used these things like actively on a daily basis. That's this episode. Thank you very much for listening. See you next week. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening, and keep the source open.